Good evening. It's evening time now. It's 7:14 p.m. on Saturday, February 3rd, 2024. And Mom and I are sitting on the couch trying to answer some tough questions that Mikel has asked us. And the one we chose to work on tonight is what was the biggest problems that we, or challenges that we encountered in our life, and how did we overcome them? And there's been so many that it would be hard to pick some out, but we discussed it a little bit. And I'm going to let Mom start, and we'll just kind of bounce back and forth between each other. And we're talking about challenges that we encountered together, and then some that we encountered individually before we were married, because we weren't quite sure how to answer that question as individuals or as a married couple. So again, Mikel, thank you, and here we go. All right, dear.
Hey, dear. One of the things that we both struggled with was when Tracy, when we found out Tracy had AFib, is that what she had?
Perthes disease?
Okay, you're going to start there? Okay. Yeah. Perthes disease, which is kind of like a tuberculosis of the hip, because it has all this calcium, and then it starts to lose the calcium.
And how old was she? We were living in Livonia.
Yeah.
On Mainfield Street. How old was she? Three, maybe?
She was walking already, so I don't remember exactly how old she was. It was a few years that she had to deal with this, but they had to put something to immobilize her hips. So they put her in what you call Perthes disease, but they put her in a twister strap. And this was a elastic strap that went around each leg, and then it fastened to like a garter on her, around her hips. And it was to keep her hips from moving too much until this healed, which took a long time.
So these twister straps, just to give you a little clear visual picture of it, were wound around her leg from her ankles all the way up to her hips, as Mom just said. And were very taut on her and prevented her from twisting her hips. And how long did she have to wear those? Do you remember?
I think long enough for that to heal the, or keep it in place while the hip was breaking down, or the calcium in her hips were breaking down, and then it had to build back up again. I don't remember. I think a couple years.
Yeah.
Because I think we had to go and get it done a couple times because her shoe sizes would change. And then we'd had to get a new twister strap that would go around her legs, like Dad said. And then you had to hook it on like it was a buckle that you put on. And we had to do that every time she had to go to the bathroom or went to bed. Otherwise, she had it on all day, which was very cumbersome. But she was a trooper. She figured it out how to walk with it on. And
you can imagine her walking with stiff legs. Would that be an accurate description?
Also pigeon-toed.
And pigeon-toed, yeah. Yeah. So she couldn't bend her knee.
She could bend it, but not all the way. Because it was the strap came up her leg and then hooked into hooked up into a buckle that was on her hip to keep it immobile. And she managed to walk, she managed to ride her bike in it even, But obviously she had a hard time
walking.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember one of the absolute, well, it brought tears. I can still feel it and remember it to this day, was standing on our porch in Livonia when you had taken Tracy somewhere and you had parked the car out front. And I was standing on the porch and you got Tracy out of the car and Tracy saw me standing on the porch and she started running towards me and she had her arms open like she was excited to see me and was going to throw them around me. And it was so hard and awkward for her to run stiff-legged. And it was just a... just seeing her
struggling
in such pain and making such an effort. She was smiling and she was running to me with her arms open. She was totally
off balance too.
Well, she was, but just the fact that she was so focused and excited to see me broke my heart, knowing that she was in this contraption that was so painful to her.
She was a trooper. She got used to it. I mean, it was a lot of putting it on and taking it off at bedtime and at nap time, and it was a struggle for her, but she came through it.
Then the next terrible. I still have, I don't want to say nightmares about it, but it was far and away one of the hardest things I had to do, because we did not know that Tracy had a heart issue at the time, but she was having, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, son, she was having a lot of UTIs.
She had, the way we discovered it is because I gave her a bath and I put her in the nice warm bath water and she peed out blood. So that was our first inclination, that she had some sort of a kidney problem.
And so we took her, I believe it was Sinai Hospital.
I don't remember.
At the time, right? It's in downtown Detroit.
Well, we took her to a urologist because of the urine and the blood in the urine.
But we had to take her to the hospital to do that. What was that called? A polygram?
Yeah.
And they had to, and keep in mind, this would have been early 1970s, and they didn't have a lot of the modern technology today, nor did they have a lot of the modern painkillers. And so this doctor, I remember her laying on a marble table, and this doctor was going to run a catheter up through her urethra. Was it going into the... Where was it going?
Urethra up through the cat... The...
What, hon?
Oh, shoot.
But he was doing an exam with it.
They were going to do an x-ray.
Yes.
IV pyogram.
IV.
They ran the tubes up...
her urethra.
Yeah. And then...
And Tracy, the doctor, before he started the procedure, he asked me, Miss McCloskey, hold your daughter down on the table. She can't move, and this is going to be extremely painful. And then he started to insert the catheter or the probe, and Tracy just screamed. And
the problem is these tubes were not for a baby, and she was a baby. I mean, she was in diapers, and they were trying to push this up through her ureters, and it was obviously way too big. But they didn't have a children's one. It seems to me they sent out and got something that was a little bit easier, but it was still too tight to get up through her uterus. So she was bleeding all over the place from that. And obviously, when you're trying to put something that's way too big into something that's way too small, it was painful and it was bleeding.
And it was, I felt so helpless because a parent isn't made to inflict pain that she was experiencing on their children. And I still, after all these years, I still feel guilty that there wasn't something that I could do to ease that and make that. But like she's always been, she was such a trooper. I mean, obviously she was in pain, but once it was over, she was okay.
They had to send upstairs or send someplace to get a smaller one because they wouldn't have been able to get the dye up through there either. So they had to replace it with something else. I mean, I think they did a lot of improvising because here was an infant. Well, an infant, she was still in diapers, and I don't know.
Didn't they start the, it's just coming back, didn't they start the procedure and the doctor couldn't get it any further, and that's when they went upstairs and...
I don't know. They realized that was way too small for her, or big.
Yeah.
So they sent someplace to get a smaller one, which it was smaller, but...
It was just like torture. And then we found out Tracy only had one kidney. And, of course, you're concerned, well, what does that mean for a healthy life? Well, that wasn't the end of the problems either, because it wasn't too long after that. In fact, it was just before we moved to Manistee, we found out that she had an atrial septal defect. She had a hole the size of a quarter in her heart, and it had to be fixed. And again, we're looking at a life, at that time, a life or death situation. And the doctors decided to wait until she was 9 years old, right, hon?
No, I think more like seven.
Okay.
Because it was right around her first Holy Communion. And they said the reason they were waiting that long is they wanted her heart to get as close to full size so she wouldn't have to have, you know, several surgeries because she would outgrow it. So they waited till she was, after she had her first Holy Communion, and I don't know how old she was, maybe 7 or 8.
By that time we were living in Manistee, so we brought her down to Children's Hospital and downtown Detroit for the procedure. And that was beyond, I can't describe how frightening that was. And I'm going to let Mom explain what this, well, we were in the quiet room, what they call the quiet room. This was, and Tracy had a team of doctors. I think there were 8 or 9 doctors that were involved in this. And it took months to plan. And after all these problems that we've been discussing, this is really the moment where the rubber hits the road, because now she's going into open heart surgery. And the anxiety that we've had and the worry has just wreaked havoc on us. And so now we're just moments away from giving our daughter to some, not strangers, because we knew all the doctors, but we were no longer in control of anything that was going to happen to her. And I remember they had a room right outside of the emergency room or the operating room. And I remember we got to go in there with her. She's on the gurney. She's all prepped. And she was semi-conscious, ready to go in. And Dr. Arcenegas, I'll never forget his name, he was considered one of the best pediatric cardiologists in the world, stepped in. And there was just Tracy and Dr. Arcenegas and Mom and I. And he was all messed up and ready to go. And he said, "Do you have any last questions?" And I had never had the courage to ask this question before. So I said to him, "Will she make it?" And he looked at me and he said, "I have never lost one yet." And away they took her. That was the last thing. And so I don't remember how long the operation was. It was hours long. And now I'm going to let Mom describe when they brought her into recovery. Mom, I didn't go in. Well, I did eventually, but Mom and her mother, Viola, went into the recovery room when she was ready for it. And I'll let Mom describe that.
Well, I think that's when Mom broke down and started crying. And I did too, and I'm trying to console her. And I look out, and there's Dad in the corridor having a cigarette because he had quit smoking before that, but he couldn't stand the anguish and worry and everything. So he went outside the hospital door and started smoking. Do you remember that, Mike?
I do. Okay. I walked all over pediatric. That's another story in itself, but go ahead.
And we were both obviously very concerned that this could be a life and death operation, you know. We're talking about her heart, and it was a little heart, you know.
And they were going to
tiny little heart.
They were going to take it out of her body to fix it. Go ahead, tell them what the when she came in to intensive care after surgery looked like.
Well, obviously, she was all covered with sheets and sterile sheets and all that stuff and tubes all over her, and the heart pump that was keeping her heart going. It was a sight to see. Then I started crying. Here I am trying to console my mom, and maybe that was a good thing though, because I was worried about her passing out, and that kept me focused on her and not just Tracy.
This room that she was in, as I remember it, wasn't much bigger than a large closet. And three of the four walls, there was a table in there, looked like, as I remember it, an operating table or something similar. And I had never seen anything like it. Three of the four walls, from floor to ceiling, were covered with dials and tubes and gauges and pumps, all designed to keep Tracy alive while her body tried to heal itself. Is that an accurate description, hon?
Probably, except that I had been in a surgery room before, so I didn't have the same effect there. But what I had was when she came back and was just hooked up to so many tubes and IVs and, you know, emptying the bladder, that was another tube.
And I think I counted, and my memory obviously isn't what it used to be, or maybe it never was to begin with, but I want to say she had 18, 20 tubes in her and
I don't know.
Connections. And
I don't know if her little body could have taken that many.
But anyway.
Obviously, she was incontinent, so they had catheter in her the whole time, and then she had the heart pump to keep her heart going, so that was another noisy thing and a big thing. And then she had IVs for everything else, and then she had catheters and like a something to catch her stool, and She was just hooked up with all these. That in itself was scary to see, and that's when Grandma passed out, because she'd never seen all this. I had, you know, from being in surgeries before, but it was probably very scary for me, because that's my baby laying there. But I didn't, seeing all the tubes and all the things going on, I've seen all that before, but it's your own child. It's something different.
Well, and Mikkel asked, and how did you handle it? And
prayer.
Yes, that's one of the first and earliest times that our belief in God and trust in God was on the line, because you are so helpless. You have zero control. And for a human being, being in control is kind of our primal instinct. And the only thing we could do was pray. And the only thing we could do was trust that somehow we would move God to answer our prayer and not take our little baby who we had wanted, Tracy being the first, we'd wanted all of you, but we'd had difficulty. We'd lost two or three before, right, hon?
Two.
Three, okay.
Two, I think.
I think you're right, baby. So, Tracy, we wanted her so bad, and not to be able to achieve that was unthinkable. But as we now know, everything worked out. God answered our prayers. Another very difficult period in our lives. I was a high school coach. I'd been coaching down in the Detroit Catholic League at that time for about 8 years, and I had set a timetable. I wanted to be coaching Division I football by the time I hit my 35th birthday, so I was on a time schedule. And back then, it was very easy for teachers and coaches to move around. And I had started my coaching career coaching 7th and 8th grade football at LA Osaros in Farmington, Michigan, which happened to be my grade school that I went to. And after 8 years, I had worked my way up to, I was the number one assistant on Bishop Borges's football staff, which at that time was the largest Catholic high school in the state of Michigan. We had 1,400 students. And I was ready to be a head coach. I had to go make my own way in the coaching world, and I had a schedule to be on. So I had started applying all over the state for head coaching positions, and I ended up interviewing and getting the job at Catholic Central High School in Manistee, which was absolutely one of the greatest high schools outside of the one that I graduated from. We were only there 2 years, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. But what was hard was Manistee was 250 miles from where we were living. And Mom and I didn't know a soul up there. And it was probably harder on Mom than me to move, because she had family here, and my father had died, my sister had died, and I essentially didn't have very much family. But to show you what kind of a woman your mother is, she put that aside, and we had some serious talks about it. And she said, "I'm going to support you in whatever you want to do." And again, I was being very selfish, and I was on this mission to get into college coaching. And so, Mom, when the job was offered, and I said, "Okay, decision time," she said, "We're going." And then
I don't remember saying that.
Well,
I do remember saying, This is your decision.
Yes. And tell them we moved up.
And I cried all the way to Manistee.
Yeah. We had a green, I want to say it was the 1970 Pontiac station wagon. And Mom drove that. And what did I drove something else. Oh, our car. Or no, you drove, I don't remember, but you drove one vehicle and I drove other.
Do we have two cars?
Yeah. Well, I got up there. We were in separate vehicles.
You were?
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah. But that was roughly a four-hour drive, and Mom had...
And I did it.
And you cried all the way up to Manistee.
No. I think I cried all the way home from Manistee.
You did do that, too.
It was it both times.
Yeah, I did. When I went up, when they offered me the job over the phone and I had to go up and sign my contract, I took Mom up and, you know, we looked around Manistee and bought a home, a brand new home that was just being built. But it was, what was I? How old was I? I was about 30, 31, 32, and I hadn't been away from home, and you hadn't been away from home, and all we had was each other, and it was two wonderful years up there, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. It was beautiful up there, and obviously we became very dependent and close to each other because that's all we had was us up there.
Yeah.
So we took lots of long walks. We met some beautiful friends that were all football parents of Dad's team. And they were so generous to us. When we came up to look around, they put us up in a cabin or a house, cottage, whatever. And they stocked the refrigerator with food for a week. And they gave me a shower for Shannon. And they gave me a buggy and all these neat gifts. And this was a new football coach, you know. They didn't even know us, but they were very supportive of the school, the football program, and Dad. So that was helped us a lot to fit in.
But that was probably the really good thing was about it was, as Mom said, all we had was each other. And so we had a lot of heart-to-heart talks, but Mom and I almost every night, rain, even in the snow, we lived a quarter of a mile, half a mile from the lake. And we both had bicycles, and we'd either put the kids in put Tracy in a, I don't know what we put her in. But anyway, we either rode our bikes or walked down to the beach and watched the sunset almost every single night. Or in the winter, we watched the ice jams. That's the first time I ever heard snow crack or snow ice crack. And it sounded like a cannon going off, and I almost fell off the cliff because we were standing on a cliff. It scared the bejabbers out of me. But it was so just the three of us standing on that high cliff looking down on Lake Michigan. So that was another difficult.
There was four of us by then.
Well, when Shannon came along, yeah. That's another favorite story of mine that Shannon's heard from me every birthday in her life. Certainly one of the hardest that we've had to encounter together would obviously be Mom's stroke. And you were all a part of that. And you saw how tough Mom was. you saw how precious life is, how unpredictable life is, how valuable every moment of life is, that the key to it, or a key to it, to life, is family and the bond that holds the family together. And so I'm going to, Mom and I really didn't discuss this too much, so I'm going to let her talk right off the cuff here.
I think in the beginning, when I had the stroke, it was not, I didn't understand everything that was going on. So I think it was toughest on Dad and all you guys in the beginning, because there was a threat that I could have another stroke any minute, and all these other, you know, they give you the worst things that could happen before they say anything. So you have that to think about if something happens, I think. But I had a difficult time through the whole thing just because I didn't feel like I was in control anymore.
And the question, how does that manifest itself, to understand the significance of what Mom said? Imagine waking up from I don't know how many days of druggery, being under the influence of drugs, and knowing that A, you're not the same person you were the last time you can remember. And secondly, there's nothing you can do about it. And third, and most important, and this is maybe what Mom's trying to say, what's my purpose in life now? Because prior to this moment, I will tell you, Mom's only and sole and most important reason for living was to look after you guys.
And you.
Yes, and me. To be a good wife and a good mother. And Mom literally is a saint, even if she hasn't been officially blessed as a saint. But if you can imagine, Mom's identity, her reason for living, was to be a mother and a wife. And all of a sudden, she can't do it like she did it before. And she still struggles to this day with that. Would you agree, hon?
Yeah, I don't know how many times I've said to Dad, I don't feel like... I don't feel like me anymore. I just want to be what I used to be. Be able to do the things I used to do. Just makes me feel very frustrated. And there's nothing I can do about it. Just keep praying. Maybe you should cut that all out.
What, hon?
So maybe you should cut all that out.
Well, I will tell you, I've tried, you know, and this is to the part of Mikkel's question, what do you do about it? I've tried to emphasize to each and every one of you, all the grandkids, spouses, how important a phone call is to Mom, a text is to Mom, an email is to Mom. Taking just 2 or 3 minutes to say hello. How's your day going? I'm thinking of you. I'm here with her 24 hours a day most of the time. And when her first question every single morning to me is, did we hear from anybody? Who'd we hear from? Who's texted? Who's called? The last question at night. I sit on her bed and I read her all her texts and emails from the day. That's her last thoughts at night, because her life has been so dramatically changed and she feels so disconnected. But I will absolutely tell you the best medicine, better than all the drugs she's getting, is when she gets a call, a text, an email, a FaceTime from each and every one of you. And she will say it over and over and over. I feel so happy when my family's around. And then, then when you guys all go down the driveway and down the road, and she's standing in the doorway waving to you when you're down on the main road, then the sadness starts in, because you're all gone. You are her reason and purpose in life. And for a few minutes, you were with her and you made her feel like she had a reason to live. And then all of a sudden, you're gone again. And that's really hard on her. Am I getting that correct, hon?
I miss all of you when I'm not with you, including Dad. I'm going to start crying again. Sometimes I get so lonely at night, I go in and crawl in bed with Dad. Since the stroke, you just make you realize how important everybody is in your life. So just remember that with your own families too.
Well, we try to keep this to a half an hour, and I think I'm running a little bit over, and I'd like to finish with just one personal difficulty that I had before I met Mom, because I didn't know it at the time, the lesson I was learning. But you all know, when I was 9 years old, I was hit by a drunk driver as I was riding my bike home from a Boy Scout meeting one night. And so this would have been 1949. And again, we didn't have an emergency service ambulances. Still at that time, the ambulance services were run by funeral homes, if you can imagine that. But anyway, when I was hit by the drunk, the hospital that they took me to, Mount Carmel Hospital in Detroit, was about a 20-minute drive from Farmington. And I was hit on a corner of Middle Belt and 10 Mile Road in Farmington. And I had a compound fracture in my right leg. My left leg was fractured. Left arm was fractured in a couple of spots. The metal shield that went over the headlight of the car that hit me had severed my left arm, and the only thing that stopped it from being completely cut off was the bone. So it cut it right to the bone. I remember, I don't know how it all happened, because I was unconscious for most of the time, but they got my dad and he rode to the hospital in the ambulance with me. And I didn't regain consciousness for 3 days. And during that time, the doctors told Dad that they didn't think I was going to make it. I had major head injuries, as you can imagine. But at any rate, I did. And the point that I wanted to make, I was in a cast that literally from the tip of my toes to my armpits with cutouts to urinate and to defecate. And that was at my dad. I had a bar that went between my two legs that my dad would grab to pick me up, to carry me, to lift me around the house. And I did not walk for 9 months. I was in that cast. And I remember when I went back to Mount Carmel Hospital to have that cast cut off, I was sitting on a gurney outside the casting room. And I heard the doctor that had worked on me and saved my life. He was inside getting ready to take the cast off. I heard him tell my dad, "Your son will never walk again. You know that." And I remember saying to myself when I heard that, and of course, obviously 9 years old, I don't have any comprehensive understanding of what the doctor just said. But I said to myself, "Yes, I will." And so after being in that cast for 9 months, it took me, I'm going to say maybe 2 years before I could walk again. And during that time, I can't tell you how many times I fell, how many times I crawled on my belly to get to the bathroom. And once I did begin to walk, both legs would give out for no reason. I'd be walking and all of a sudden they'd give out and I'd fall. And that happened even after I went back to school. In fact, it happened probably until I was 12 or 13 years old. And I'd be out in public and walking and all of a sudden I'm on the ground. The reason I tell you that is because I simply would not concede that I would never walk again. And I guess never giving up. And I think when you have a goal in life, and you have to, don't listen to what other people say. That doctor was wrong. And the number of people that told me that I probably wouldn't walk again. And I went on to have a fairly normal life playing high school sports. So that was a major event in my life that helped me understand, I don't care what anybody else says. I'm only going to trust what I know, what I believe in. I don't care if you tell me, I did. People did tell me I wasn't smart enough. I wasn't tall enough. I wasn't fast enough. And that's why a lot of you in a family say I'm so bullheaded and you think I know all the answers. I don't. I'm always searching for answers. But I do have extreme
faith. Faith.
Yeah, I trust my own judgment. I don't mind failing in life. I mean, all those times I've fallen down were failures. All the times that I've failed in my life, every single one of those failures was not a failure because I refused to let them be a failure, because I saw them as opportunities to figure out a different way to succeed. And that's been the story of my life. I've failed more times in more ways than all of you guys probably combined. But failure has always been the best way I've learned, as opposed to having success all my life, because you don't really learn to be creative, to be mentally tough, to persist, to have character. And so I would leave you with that.